Content warning. The following podcast contains discussion of ableism and self-harm. This was recorded before the announcement of the passing of director Corey Ewan.
You're watching Channel 37. WHXN. New Salem.
We're at the end of another season of Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. We're celebrating the achievements of a panoply of stars. Mostly we're looking at goofy early stuff. First, Michelle Yeoh kicked off her career with the fairly awesome Yes Madam. Then, Sandra Bullock was in the somewhat less awesome Bionic Showdown. Finally, Renee Zellweger preceded two award wins by singing on a store marquee in Empire Records.
Hello and welcome to Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. I'm Dan, and with me are Dave.
Hello.
Will.
It's friggin' Rex Manning Day.
And Wendy.
Damn the man. Save the Empire.
It is our third season finale, so we've always got a bit of a blowout happening when we do that. So it wouldn't be a season ender without a gimmick, and this time around we are looking at early movies from future Oscar winners. It turns out that is a very, very, very full field.
Everyone's got to get their start someplace.
Exactly. Everybody's got to get, you know, Menachem Golan has to, you know, hire people that, you know, eventually turn out to be pretty good, it turns out.
You're real good. A professional.
Go and put that away or I'll call for help.
Richard. CID, there's been a murder. Call the police.
Richard Norman worked for Scotland Yard. He came to Hong Kong to investigate the Tin Holding case and got himself killed.
Don't move. CID.
Senior Inspector Anna Young.
The lady from Scotland Yard.
Thank you!
Get back to the kitchen, the two of you.
Back up!
You're too late!
This time around, we narrowed it down. We went to Best Actress Oscar winners from the 21st century, and there were still like 15 movies to choose from. But we started off with the 1985 Yes, Madam, featuring a very young Michelle Yeoh. Well, this movie was barely about anything at all, quite honestly.
It was about ass kickery.
It was about ass kickery.
And that ladies can do it better than men.
And three of the dumbest thieves ever.
Well, it wouldn't be a Hong Kong action comedy without three of the dumbest criminals ever. So basically, somebody out there did some bad stuff and somebody else caught it on microfilm. And the microfilm ends up in the hands of aforementioned three dumbest criminals ever. And it is up to Michelle Yeoh, and they have to bring in Cynthia Rothrock from Scotland Yard to, yeah, I know, to track down whatever nonsense is happening. That's basically it. That's the plot. And, you know, there's kind of goofy comedy in between scenes of the ladies kicking all kinds of ass all over the place. Had anybody seen this before?
I had.
Okay, Will, when did you see it last?
I watched it like right before the last time we talked about a Cynthia Rothrock film.
Mm-hmm. I should say, in addition to this being Michelle Yeoh's first starring vehicle, it was also Cynthia Rothrock's first movie. So that's pretty cool. Who, of course, we remember from Righting Wrongs, which was also directed by Corey Yuen, who was the director of this movie. And you can tell because there's a lot of the same faces.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Will, what did you think?
I mean, it's a film that I heavily enjoyed. Yes, mm-hmm. pretty much anytime that the three dumbest thieves in the world, it was just them on screen with maybe like anyone trying to attack them, the film kind of wasn't that great. Mm-hmm. But anytime it was Michelle Yeoh, anytime that it was Cynthia Rothrock doing anything, it was like, yes, this is what I'm here for. This is awesome. Okay, yeah, short haired glasses, Michelle Yeoh is so freaking hot.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just like, and the last, pretty much when you get to like the last fight scene, like it is like just so excellently choreographed. Like that's why you're coming to a Hong Kong kung fu film, because mm-hmm. they are just excellence in artistry. Mm-hmm. Everything is just very tight. Sometimes they're so tight that you get to the point where it's like, okay, we ran out of budget. We ran out of the time that the studio allotted us. The movie needs to end. We're just going to make it end.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not there to think too hard.
Yeah.
Dave, how about yourself?
Obviously, I've seen the fighting clips of this mm-hmm. online on multiple occasions, and it is absolutely worth the price of admission for that final fight, which is amazing. Yeah. Although there are some great kind of smaller skirmishes earlier on in the film as well. But yeah, it sort of feels like two completely different films smushed together. So yeah. You've got sort of like the adventures of Panadol, Strepsil and Aspirin. As aforementioned, the three of the dumbest criminals ever to draw breath. And they're kind of being caught in the middle of this battle between, Cynthia Rothrock and Michelle Yeoh and maniacal laughter enthusiast Mr. Tin. But then, I mean, I actually thought there were some good bits, like the bit where the guy that Panadol sold the passport to comes back to kick his ass, and Panadol's got all these different escape bits in his place. Was quite fun. It was quite Looney Tunes. I mean, like at one point, like yeah, Panadol does hand the guy a dummy of himself with a stick of dynamite in it, and he's waiting for him around the corner with a big hammer and stuff. And it's proper cartoon stuff.
Yeah.
So that was kind of fun. But yeah, it's but every time sort of like those characters and Rothrock and Yeoh interact, it feels like they're crossing over in two entirely separate films. Mm-hmm. Like one of them is an amazing kick-ass martial arts film, and the other one is I don't know what. A weird criminal comedy where kind of like a parking attendants get into violent fights with each other about who gives the ticket to a car. overall, I liked it, and even the bits of the silly half of the film, I didn't mind,
mm-hmm.
Because like the fighting is very much worth it. But I mean, you can see like Michelle Yeoh has got star quality written all over her. Like that opening scene when she kind of like, well, I mean, obviously the bit where she captures or flashes. Meeting to mention a book right at the start is excellent. But then when she goes on to do that and then foils an entire robbery single-handedly. Well, the bit that made me laugh was that right at the end, like, she calls the last guy and practically shoots his hand off with a shotgun when he goes for his gun. And then the other police turn up and go, is this one of them? And he's like, I bloody well hope so. So no, it's fine. Yeah, this guy was just pissing me off.
I don't know, some guy.
Is this one of them? Nah, fair enough.
Awesome, thank you. Wendy, how about yourself?
I mean, yeah, that opening scene where she's taking down the bad guys and all that gunplay is just amazing. She's so, so good in this. Michelle Yeoh, she's just incredible. She's great through this whole movie. She's super cute. And she will just destroy you. And it's always great to see Cynthia Rothrock. I love like the tropes of these action movies, and even when they're set like in cities, sometimes they're there. Like, you don't get a tea house scene in a movie set in the modern day, but you do get a bunch of old men sitting around picking over a chicken they're not supposed to be eating. and a few minutes of Sammo Hung in a wig, which always makes me happy. And that fight scene in Panadol's apartment is amazing. That's like the bamboo forest / ladder fight, right? That we should have in a movie like this. And yeah, it's just absolutely, I mean, it's ridiculous, but it's delightful. Like, every second of that fight scene is amazing. But yeah, the whole story about like these three petty criminals, it's just dumb. They're dumb. I feel like they deserve a better antagonist. But we work our way up to that final boss fight, right? And the first time we saw the interior of the boss's house, I lost my shit because I knew we were going to have an incredible fight scene in all that like unnecessary wood and glass that's just all over. None of that makes any sense unless it's just there to throw people through. And it was.
And it makes sense if you're 80s Nuevo rich.
I don't feel like there would be that much wood. Definitely there would be a lot of glass. But it was so exciting to see that all get smashed. And I spent like the first half of this movie like wondering why that guy's name was Aspirin before Googling and realizing that all three of them are named after over-the-counter medications. I had never heard of Strepsil or Panadol before.
Yeah, their brands over here as well. Like, Strepsils are like throat lozenges. For when you got a sore throat.
I mean, it makes sense.
Panadol's a painkiller.
Yeah, so they're basically named like aspirin, Halls, and Tylenol.
Yeah. Benadryl.
Yeah. This movie was so much fun. And did Cynthia Rothrock, it's always fucking amazing to see her. She's so glorious to watch on screen. Her technique is so clean. Her lines are so good. She has the best poses, and this was fantastic. I'm so glad that we watched this one.
Yeah, you always feel like, you know, well, we need somebody to kick someone in the face from a standing position. Bring in Cynthia Rothrock. And I guess it makes sense that the criminals were kind of named after British over-the-counter medicines. So of course, this was when Hong Kong was still British. So I guess that does actually make sense. That would have been like an everyday medicine over there, very recognizable, that maybe we don't get here. Yeah, I'm kind of with everybody else. This movie is delightful. Absolutely fucking delightful. The fighting scenes are incredible. The not fighting scenes are less so. But the action scenes are just amazing. That opening armored car robbery is incredible. Like, Wendy lost her shit when Michelle Yeoh just straight up shot that guy in the face and the back of his head blew out.
That was amazing.
It's like, oh, it's this kind of movie. That got category 3 real quick. But it actually calmed down quite a bit after that. Yeah, no, that scene was amazing. It's amazing to see, like, because Michelle Yeoh obviously at this point was not a trained martial artist. I would not have guessed that. She's excellent in those scenes. She's really, really good.
Yeah. And because it's Hong Kong, everyone's doing their own stunts. So that's her, you know, getting thrown through glass. That's her getting her like punching people. Or, you know, close.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I heard somebody once, and it's probably true. It's like, it's not a million miles away from pro wrestling, where it's like, you train to not inflict as much damage as you possibly could, but you're getting hurt. Like, you're doing that shit for real. And you are kind of walking away from this with a whole lot of analgesic in your system when this is over. Because you did, in fact, get thrown through one of those 80s glass block wall things.
Break out the Panadol and aspirin.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, the comedy, it's very broad, and it's not something that we're used to over here. Like, this style of comedy. I don't find it particularly funny most of the time. But you don't have to wait too long for somebody to throw something at somebody else. You know? So just give yourself a minute, and at some point, Cynthia Rothrock will be here to cause severe damage to some poor unfortunate extra.
In a way, I kind of wish they'd given a bit more room to the relationship between Cynthia Rothrock and Michelle Yeoh. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, yeah, they're doing like the old buddy cop thing of they initially don't like each other, and then they respect each other, and then they kind of join forces and fight at the end. You know. But we don't really see much of that. Well, you see a little bit of it, but yeah, it would have been nice to see a little bit more of that relationship changing, because, like, you know, you get the thing initially where Detective Ng is quite, you know, I mean, like, she's very brutal when she's taking down people, but she's actually gonna, you know, she's good at coaxing information out of people in a friendly way.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way she kind of like teases Panadol to accidentally identify his co-conspirators and stuff. whereas Cynthia Rothrock just beats the shit out of people in prison cells.
Yeah.
just like put cigarettes out of their own face and stuff. Yeah. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's how we do it at Scotland Yard.
British police brutality.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like regular police brutality, but with more tea.
Yeah.
Occasionally a funny hat.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, Cynthia Rothrock is about as British as I am.
She wears tweed at the start. That's all you need.
Yeah, exactly.
So I know Dan provided a couple different ways of watching this. I watched it with the Chinese dub. Did anyone watch it with the English dub?
I watched it with the English dub, basically because I was being lazy and it was on Tubi, and that was the only version I could watch.
Yeah, we watched it with the English dub as well.
Yeah, okay. It's sort of strange hearing. Because obviously, knowing that I know what Michelle Yeoh's voice sounds like, hearing some random American voiceover artist doing her voice instead was took a little bit of getting used to. But, like, to be honest, a film like this, you're not here for the dialogue.
No.
You're not here for the witty repartee and the writing. You're here to watch people get punched in the face and beaten up with various household implements. And that happened in... it's a universal language.
Well, here's the thing as well. Depending on how you're watching this film, because it is a Hong Kong film, it's done in Cantonese, but also then dubbed in Mandarin, so there's a chance you're still not hearing Michelle Yeoh's voice, depending on which dialect you're getting.
Yeah.
Like, I think the one that we had was the Mandarin, and because I'm like... That doesn't really sound like her, but also she's a lot younger, so of course her voice is going to be different. Yeah. But in the case of, like, Cynthia Rothrock, it's like, okay, yeah, you don't want to... I think maybe they thought, okay, nobody's going to be able to tell she's British or not when she's speaking Chinese the entire film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right, Will. I think that the version that we had was in Mandarin. We did watch the dub, although normally we would watch the sub. I think we just... We're like, you know, if we're not going to, you know, if we're taking notes and not completely paying attention 100% of the time, it makes sense to be able to just listen.
That's exactly right. That's why we watched the dub.
It wasn't a great dub. It wasn't fantastic. I do find that humor like this and dialogue in general tends to work better when you're watching the sub because it reads better than it sounds. I guess. I don't know if that's the right.
Yeah, no, I see what you mean, yeah.
It's not like the old API Godzilla dubs.
Right.
Yeah, and I think there's also that thing of when you're watching a dub, sometimes you need to, you know, so it's like that old Wayne's World joke when you sort of like somebody says one word and the actual translation is like 15 sentences. You know, like so while the dub has to convey what's going on, at the same time it has to kind of match the mouth, yeah, the amount of time the person is speaking. Yeah, they can't keep going on once the actor has stopped talking, you know. So yeah, and it, sometimes clunky dialogue can, like you say, you can read better than it sounds when it's being spoken, just because, you know, I think just that kind of cognitive difference, I think, in between sort of reading something and hearing something.
Yeah, it's similar to like when you're watching anime, you know, sometimes it just doesn't sound right when it's in English, you know, even though they do pay more attention to things like lip flap than they used to, that dissonance is kind of still there.
Yeah. And any scripts in a specific language will follow kind of like the rhythm of that language as well. And when it gets when it gets literally translated into a different language, the rhythm's wrong because, I mean, even things like noun placement and stuff is different. So it just kind of like, sometimes, it just sort of ruins the kind of lyrical pacing of the dialogue, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, honestly, like a good person to do, like to write like the dub script is honestly, like it's an undersung like skill because you can do a literal translation, but one, if you're not matching the movement of the mouth, if you're just going for exactly what they say, it doesn't always work as well. Like sometimes you kind of have to, you're just translating the gist and then to make it more relatable. There's a film I ended up watching last night that was originally it's a Japanese anime, and they ended up, we left the subtitles on because we were watching on Amazon, and they're not exactly one for one the same, but it really felt like, okay, yeah, that if they were just saying what they said there, it just doesn't work as well.
I don't know if you know, it's a trip is like when you watch something like that where you have the English dub on and then also have the English subtitles on, and you just see where they absolutely don't even kind of talk to each other in any way.
Or there's dialogue where there was no dialogue before.
Yeah. But to get back to the movie, Michelle Yeoh was only 22 years old when she made this, and is 2 years out from being Miss Malaysia World. That was kind of her in to the industry. She's wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. As you say, Dave, she's just charisma to spare.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think the costume she's given, I mean, her and Cynthia Rothrock are given some fantastic kind of costumes. Those kind of really kind of 80s kind of baggy jumpsuit kind of things work really well in this film, and like, especially for the action scenes. It almost kind of gives them kind of like superhero costumes in a way, you know. So that's really good. And yeah, like she handles the dialogue scenes really well, I think. It's like, yeah, I think she sort of establishes herself in this as like a complete package in so far that, you know, yes, you know, she could do the martial arts, she could do the acting, which, you know, not everybody who could do martial arts could do the acting. Mm-hmm. And vice versa, of course, obviously. And yeah, so you can see that, like, yeah, this was a real kind of star-making film for her.
Mm-hmm. Like, I would honestly say, you see, like, what will make Michelle Yeoh, like, eventually an Oscar-winning actress in this film. I mean, there is still, like, just that star quality to her. But honestly, like, if I'm being 100% honest, like, she should have gotten a nomination for Crouching Tiger, but once again, Hollywood is very... will always discriminate against Asian language films as far as actors go, because it's like, oh, you're just punching things. You're just hitting things. And it's like, but there is like so much to what she does in this film. There's so much what she does in a lot of films. And I'm glad, you know, what she ended up winning her Oscar for, she's still getting to do what she does here, but also able to, you know, do it as a dramatic role as well. And I mean, I'll be honest, I will 100% see a film sometimes just because Michelle Yeoh's in it, because she is just awesome. I mean, freaking Crazy Rich Asians is delightful, partially because of her. And showing pretty much when we recorded this, Wicked just came out, and oh my God, she is just like, she is absolutely like one of the best parts of a wonderful film.
And when she turned up as a captain in Star Trek Discovery, when that was announced, it's because, like, you had my interest anyway because it's new Star Trek, but, like, you know, that kind of casting was just sort of like, oh, okay, right.
She is so good in that role.
Yeah.
And they're giving her her own spin-off film.
I can't wait for that movie.
Amen.
I can't believe I still haven't seen, somehow, we have not yet seen Everything Everywhere All at Once, and I don't know how we've gotten this far without seeing it.
I cannot watch that film without crying.
But yeah, I mean, to your point, I mean, obviously, I mean, I agree with you, Will. She absolutely should have been nominated for Crouching Tiger. She was so good in that movie. Everybody, I mean, it was just a fantastic movie anyway. But she was especially, especially good in it.
And she's also probably like one of the, she's probably one of the top two or three Bond girls.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I mean, like, one of the things they always try to do with the kind of, I mean, I dislike the term Bond girl, but the kind of, like, you know, whoever the co-star is like doing that, you know, she's just as capable as Bond thing. Like, it's what they try to do with Halle Berry in Die Another Day. But I think her role in Tomorrow Never Dies is probably the closest it gets to being kind of like someone who is a genuine equal. And sometimes superior. I love that bit in Tomorrow Never Dies when he, basically, the alarm's gone off and everybody's seen Bond and no one's seen her. So she's just like Bond's getting chased by everybody and then sort of like she's rappelling down a wall and just kind of casually waves to him. It's like, you're having a good time, are you? He's kind of like punching people into printing presses and stuff.
I don't know. She's no Christmas Jones nuclear physicist.
Oh, lordy.
Sorry, Dr. Christmas Jones.
I mean, the other weird thing about this film is there's a lot of subplots that kind of get started and never quite go anywhere, like the like the snooker hustling guy, like when they're trying, like Panadol and Aspen and Streps are trying to hustle this kind of snooker player, and it turns out like he's a world champion or something, and like they keep coming back and getting their asses kicked by this guy who's, well, apparently, you know, secretly in charge of all the people in the snooker hall.
Yeah, like, was he like a famous pool player or something? I don't know. that whole scene is weird.
Yeah, I mean, I can only assume he actually is, like, genuinely, you know, like, a snooker champion or something, just because, like, he was in the film way too much for it not to be kind of showcasing, look, we've got this guy. Yeah, and then, as I said before, like the random argument between the two parking attendants, who, like, one of them eventually gets the shit kicked out of him by Aspen and Streps or something, just because they want to get arrested. He sees the huge comedy bruises and stuff all over him.
And then there's just, like, you know, the henchman, Mad Dog, who has just like the terrible fake mustache.
Oh God, yes,
yes.
And everyone's scared of him, but when he actually goes to fight or anything, he's kind of in and out quick.
Yeah, honestly, didn't understand the point of that guy. Like Mr. Tin is a perfectly good henchman who spent most of the film doing all the killing and fighting and has been sort of like overpowering everybody and has been quite a formidable force. And then we get this other guy who seems to be kind of cosplaying the deer hunter.
He's with like an fake Rambo.
Yeah. I don't get why he's there. I don't get what he's for.
The bad guy, isn't the big boss supposed to have like the foreigner henchman?
I guess.
He's got like a U.S. Army logo on his uniform.
I almost feel like it had to be a case where they were, where maybe they got, you know, some other like American martial artist who was going to do this. Like they were going to get like, I don't know, a Chuck Norris or something. And whoever it was just decided, eh, I don't want to go to Hong Kong. And they were like, okay, we already have a costume. You were going to be random henchman number three. You're Mad Dog now.
Yeah. Yes, I know you were working the craft services table, but you're doing this now.
I just think, like, again, like, these films have tropes, and they brought some of the tropes from the traditional period films into this. And I think he's just supposed to be the foreigner henchman guy.
He's the yogi from Master of the Flying Guillotine.
Yeah, he's like the evil yogi or the Thai boxer.
The Muay Thai guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the kind of like the running gags of the fake, because Panadol's been sort of selling fake weapons. So when Strepsil goes tooled up to go deal with Mr. Tin, like everything's fake. It's like, the guns don't fire, the hand grenade turns out to play a little tune.
That actually was kind of funny.
Yeah. With the kind of literal Chekhov's gun right at the start, that there is one real gun mixed up amongst all the fake ones.
Yeah. Which it does pay off, and it pays off at the end, and I'm, as much as I will harp on this film for just ending, I'm glad that that's the way it just ends.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of dark, because, like, you know, Aspen and Strepsil are going to prison, definitely. Hey. Panadol is very dead. There's a very good chance that the two heroines are ending up in jail, because they both turned in their badges and were acting as private citizens when they stormed somebody's... Mm-hmm. Property, and like Mr. Tin says, like, he's going to sit there with his lawyers and say, I was minding my own business when these two crazy people showed up and started kicking the crap out of my staff.
It basically comes down to if the lawyer actually feels like litigating this, or if he's just going to be like, okay, cool, I'm pocketing my money. I get it regardless, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's kind of like, again, like Righting Wrongs, it's kind of a dark ending.
It is. Yeah. I was a little unexpected. It really did not match the tone of the rest of the film in the slightest.
Are these female-led films not allowed to have happy endings?
A lot of these types of films, regardless of the gender of the heroes, tend to have upsetting, suddenly, what-the-fuck endings.
Yeah, I've caught the bad guy by a trip to Fenner Wood Chipper.
Yeah. How amazing was Mr. Tin, though?
I mean, like... how anybody could not tell that he's a villain, given his propensity for laughing like Skeletor on helium.
Like the swarmiest motherfucker in the room.
Yeah.
He was so great. But yeah, like, you expect him to do that laugh and then turn and run away.
He does that laughing, and I'm like, "Are we not? Why are we not arresting this man instantly?" Like, that's a villain laugh.
Mm-hmm. Although you kind of have to give the movie a little bit of props, because it wrote itself into a thing where obviously he was going to spend about half an hour at the police station before his lawyer got him out. So, if you're going to have him have any kind of comeuppance at all, it basically had to be aspirin saying, "No, Blam."
Justice for Panadol.
Was the theme of our third season comeuppance?
I mean, looking at the three films we're covering today, yeah.
Yep. There has been a lot of comeuppance this season, I won't lie.
They say no comeuppance, but we always come back to comeuppance.
Their bionic powers brought them together, and now the power of love may unite them forever.
Please hear me out, Jamie.
But suddenly, terrorists steal their bionic secret, and not even the special powers of a female cyborg can save them.
That's not possible.
Prepare yourself for the all-new world premiere, Bionic Showdown Sunday.
Okay, so next up, we watched Bionic Showdown, The $6 Million Man and The Bionic Woman. starring a very, very young pre-Blindside, pre-Speed, Sandra Bullock, America's Sweetheart, circa 1996. This is several years before she played Practical Magic in the movie of the same name.
Name of the character was not Practical Magic.
It should have been.
How dare you?
Sally has a name.
Like, as one of the two people in this call that I'm pretty sure loves that film, how dare you?
Seriously.
To kind of pull the curtain back a little bit, every Halloween, Wendy has a
no, ritual. Every October.
Every October, sorry. Well, I mean, all of October is Halloween, isn't it? It's all spooky season.
Well, Halloween starts on Labor Day.
Yeah.
And it winds down like the day before Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Wendy has a ritual where she watches, there's several, was it three movies? It's Hocus Pocus, The Craft, and Practical Magic.
They're not even like, I mean, Hocus Pocus is a Halloween movie. Mm-hmm. They're just my fall movies. Mm-hmm. It's fall. It's time to watch the witches movies.
It kind of makes sense because it basically goes Maiden Mother Crone there.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that.
Blessed be. Let's move on.
All right, Dave, would you mind walking us through Bionic Showdown?
Certainly. Bionic Showdown is the heartwarming story of a young lady by the name of Kate, who has been in a wheelchair since she was about six, who is undergoing bionic treatment by the same person who helped rebuild Steve Austin and Jamie Summers. It is the time of glasnost and perestroika, and the world is in an uneasy peace, but the World Unity Games will be bringing everybody together, and Steve Austin has been asked to do the security for the World Unity Games, but at a reception for said games, apparently in the same building where they keep a computer that has access to all the CIA secrets, somebody bionic ends up stealing a bunch of the secrets and throws Oscar Goldman through a window. Mm-hmm. And so anybody with bionics is under suspicion because somebody was clearly somebody bionic who was involved. So while Steve and Jamie are temporarily locked up by General Gary Seven, Kate is working with Oscar's nephew, who was caught in an explosion and seemingly confined to a wheelchair as a result. And they go undercover at the games while Steve and Jamie try to identify the bionic traitor in their midst. And it all leads to a big showdown at the games with lots of different bionic people doing things with various different sound effects attached to them. But they win through and we don't get a new series that this is an obvious backdoor pilot for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
It is strangely weird to me that there is a parallel universe where this got picked up.
Yeah.
and Sandra Bullock worked on it for maybe like a season before it got cancelled and then really struggled to find work after that.
Yeah.
Probably the same universe where Knight Rider 2000 led to something.
there is no universe where Knight Rider 2000 led to something.
Fair.
Well, you know, we weren't ready for Knight Rider to come back yet. It needed a little more. It needed a little more time in the oven, and for Val Kilmer to become available.
It also needed like a failed series in the middle of the 2000s that somehow is also a prequel to Star Trek.
Oh, okay. Is there any chance anybody had actually seen this before?
No, I think I've seen bits of it before, like on Saturday afternoons, you know, like, because I know there was like there was the one before it, which was Return of the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman, and then there was Bionic Ever After, which is the one after this. Mm-hmm. So I think I've seen bits of all of them, and sort of my mind has sort of meshed them all into the same film. So it was kind of interesting to see which bits of this actually counted and which bits were probably in other films.
I feel like there's a very not zero chance that I saw this when it was on TV. I know that I've seen some of the reunion movies on TV. This may have been one of them. I don't know for sure. Because let's face it, they're all the same movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's Steven and Jamie. You know, we're kind of looking and pretending that they're not 50 and watching them beat up not Bigfoot.
I mean, if you're not bringing Bigfoot back, what are we even doing here?
What is the point of this? Oh, he's not bionic. He's just Bigfoot. Oh, God. Okay. Well, Dave, thank you for walking us through that. What did you think?
I mean, like, this is okay for what it is. You know, yeah. It's there as a bit of a like nostalgia bait. There was a lot of these things floating around in the 80s, and like the whole kind of Return from the Man from Uncle and stuff like that. And yeah, there was a lot of kind of TV movies looking to maybe try and reboot to a new series, or just kind of there for just, you know, it'd be fun to get them back and you know, get some eyes on what would be a relatively cheap project to make. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lee Majors and Lindsay Wagner are both very kind of charismatic actors. They're, you know, like, Lee Majors' easygoing southern charm is always going to be, like, yeah, I mean, that's what you made a living out of it for many, many years, and it's very much on display here, and Lindsay Wagner is always great. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not given a huge amount to do in this because, ultimately, they aren't really the focus of this. It's all about kind of trying to build up the interest in a potential new show. But I thought it was nice that they showed that, you know, kind of bionics have evolved.
Mm.
So all the stuff that's being done on Katie is to kind of, it's using electronics to kind of enhance her skeleton rather than full on. I mean, there are some implants involved, but they're not nowhere near as complicated as the full on kind of cyborg robotics that, that Jamie and Steve have. So that's nice. They've shown that kind of, you know, the science has progressed. And I did like the nice kind of plot twist of, you know, the whole kind of joke that anybody who's close to Oscar Goldman involved in an accident has, he immediately has outfitted with bionics of some sort. And which was a plot point in this, which actually turned out to be a double bluff, which was kind of like a nice kind of riff on, yeah, the old cliche from the series. Sandra Bullock is absolutely fine. She's, you know, cute as a button. You know, she's everything you'd expect from kind of early Sandra Bullock, basically. Had this gone to a series, I think she would have been a fine lead in it. I mean, I doubt the stories would have quite measured up, but like she's okay. Like, yeah, she's perfectly good. Weirdly, Lee Majors' son is in this for no reason I can readily discern. Mm-hmm. Lee Majors the second.
Lee Majors II.
who weirdly looks older than Lee Majors. Somehow. Maybe it's just the moustache. But, like, yeah, there's zero reason for him to be in it. Like, you kind of forget he's there until he walks on screen. You go, oh, yeah, that's right, he's in this. Like, the twist about the villain was pretty obvious. I mean, like, yeah, I don't have to kind of build it up a bit, but it was kind of, like, no surprise when it was actually revealed. Yeah, I mean, again, they use kind of different visual and sound effects for the kind of old and new bionics. So yeah, you get the traditional sounds from the TV show for the stuff that Jamie and Steve's doing, but whereas you get the kind of fast running, you get the Battlestar Galactica booster noise and some motion blur behind people with kind of new bionics and stuff. So this is a way of kind of marking out who's got the latest model, essentially. But like, for what this was, it was fine. You know, am I going to be in a rush to watch it again? No, not really. But I didn't feel like I'd completely wasted my time either. So, yeah, sort of a thumbs in the middle, really.
Okay. Wendy, how about yourself?
I mean, this movie was just not for me. you know, I wasn't really a fan of the original shows. I get that, like, these nostalgia movies were a big thing for a while. It hits every kind of cheesy cliche in these films. Sandra Bullock is absolutely delightful in it. As angry as I got at seeing somebody who's been unable to use her legs for her entire life suddenly get up and walk with no training to help her learn her balance. that kind of made me a little cuckoo. But, you know, she's lovely. The love story with the can of hair mousse guy is fine. He's very, like, 80s dreamy, I guess. The bad guy was so over the top that as soon as he came on screen, like, yep, that's the guy. That's the bad guy. yep, that's him. It was kind of nice to see the evolution of the bionics to, like, the transition from, you know, like, these big kind of Hulk and implants to what's basically implied to be almost like a nanotechnology. But they just don't have that word yet. Or they're not using that word. I don't know. Like, it wasn't for me. I think the thing that I liked best about this movie was realizing how much Steve Austin and OSI had influenced the Venture Brothers universe. I didn't realize the influence went so deep. I thought it was just that one throwaway Steve Austin and the Sasquatch episode.
Yeah, I mean, the Venture Brothers guys would have been exactly the right age for the $6 million man.
Yeah, I mean, they used him in an episode. Where he's, you know, he's hiding in the woods with his lover, the Sasquatch. Yeah. that's the plot line.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I remember.
But I didn't realize how much this universe had influenced that universe. Because I think of it as like, the way that I described it to Dan was like, it's as if I'm seeing Johnny Quest for the first time. Like, that was the revelation I had watching this and thinking about the Venture Brothers. Because all roads lead back to the Venture Brothers.
You mean Action Johnny.
Yeah, I can see where if you were never a six-year-old boy, that maybe you wouldn't have the same kind of relationship with the $6 million man that other people might.
Like, I remember liking the bionic woman because she was a lady, and we didn't have a lot of that, but I don't know, I was maybe too young for it. It just wasn't my jam.
Yeah, no, I get that. Will, how about yourself? What'd you think?
So I'm pretty much in the same boat as Wendy because if I'm being 100% honest, watching this movie meant that I increased the amount. I almost like more than doubled the amount of content from this franchise that I have watched in my life. And you know what? The other thing I watched, the first episode of the 2000s remake of Bionic Woman,
yeah,
which I mainly watched for Katie Sackhoff. Mm-hmm. Who isn't even the protagonist?
Nope.
For some reason.
Yeah.
But
that show was decent.
Yeah. I just watched the first episode and I didn't watch any more of it because I was like, eh, I guess. Katie Sackhoff is the main character.
Yeah.
It's Michelle Ryan. Yeah, okay. Cool. I'm sure you're not going to do a really terrible episode of Doctor Who someday.
Yeah.
Anywho, no, like, this is fine. Mm-hmm. It's not great. There's a lot of points where I'm like, one, they know who's watching this are people who are nostalgic for the original. So yeah, you have a bunch of cases where people that are obviously not in their 50s jumping over walls and stuff. You know, bionic wall jumping action, bionic wedding proposal action. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was definitely a real door that you pulled off there. It's like very transparently a pilot movie for a series that would have starred Sandra Bullock with maybe the occasional guest starring of the original actors. And okay, yeah. Now we have. And, oh yeah, and she has a love interest who, you know, if it would have went to series, I would have tuned in just to see, does he die this time? Does he finally die? No, oh, he lived. Like, literally, one of my notes is, after you found out he didn't die and, you know, the giant freaking explosion is, oh no, he lived.
Because seriously, fuck that guy.
Yeah, like, I low-key hate that character because it's like, oh, stupid jokes. And, oh, now he's in a wheelchair. But he's not really in a wheelchair. And, oh, I can't even get excited at the fact he's not wearing a shirt because it's him.
Like, when it's all revealed that the wheelchair thing was a bluff, like, him being utterly unable to understand why somebody who's been in a wheelchair for most of her life might be upset that somebody else has been pretending to need a wheelchair.
Well, that whole bit was in really poor taste.
Yeah.
What would he have done if, you know, the OSI was just like, yeah, sure, we'll give you your nephew bionics? What would he have done? It's like, oh.
Oh no, I'm bionic now, damn. Oh
no. But no. Like, and there's parts that I don't hate. Like, I don't hate Sandra Bullock in here. I'm of the mind that Sandra Bullock was perfectly fine in the 90s. And it wasn't until the 2000s that she actually became, you know, Sandra Bullock, the person who was the actress who was awesome. It took her time, which is perfectly fine. There are lots of actors who took time to become more than just, oh yeah, they're that person. But yeah, I mean, the film, it's all right. It's a made for TV movie. I can't really absolutely hate on it.
Yeah, I'm kind of there with you for the most part. It is an extremely 1989 made-for-TV reunion movie for nostalgia bait. You know, it ticks all the boxes. It's exactly what you think it's going to be going in. In a year when the trial of the Incredible Hulk happened, it can only ever be the second most important nostalgic reunion movie with a backdoor pilot in it that didn't get picked up. But, yeah, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. If you're watching this for nostalgia reasons, then you're going to wonder why Steve and Jamie are basically not in it for a good 45 minutes in the middle. But, yeah, it's Sandra Bullock is great. She does exactly the job that she's expected to do. She's absolutely adorable. And she, you know, interacts with Captain Aquanet about as well as anybody can be expected to. the main issue that I had, and again, a lot of this is just, it was 1989 and we just weren't great about this kind of thing, is how fucking ableist this movie really is.
Oh god.
Oh yeah.
You know, like, you know, the Jim, it, you know, stands up and is walking around and says, guess what? I'm not actually a misshapen mockery of a human being. I can walk. And it's, I'm just bad. Like, yeah. Yeah. If you can't walk, you might as well not even be alive. Well, I don't think that's actually true, but okay. And I understand that's kind of the point of bionics, but it really didn't age well at all.
I mean, was it really okay then?
No, but it was much more common then.
And what's to say that Jamie, you know, is just like, okay, cool. You lived most of your life. You can actually, you know, walk. You can do whatever now, but also you're drafted into the military.
Yeah.
That whole piece didn't make sense to me. Like, did she already work for OSI? Mm-hmm. They recruited her for this program, and what is her special, like, what is her training? What is her education? She just seems like a nice girl next door.
I think her qualifications are her legs don't work. and the doctor wants to make them work again to show
feel like that they'd have to done. Do like a psychological profile on of like everyone that they could use this program on, and we're like, okay, who will actually just probably unconditionally say yes once we get the ability to walk? And they were like, this girl right here, because they were like, okay, this person might actually want to have a life.
She immediately goes on a spy mission in which she both knows how to fight and is willing to like risk her life. Again, she's a perfectly lovely character, but we just don't know anything about her. We don't know that she has any training, that she knows how to go on I mean, it's dangerous to be a field agent. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I have problems with this movie. It's not believable to me, you guys. The movie about the new bionic agent in the OSI is just not passing the sniff test for me.
Listen, yeah, we know that her father grills in the middle of winter, and she makes jokes about it.
I mean, the thing is, it was the same problem with the Bionic Woman, wasn't it? Because like Jenny Summers wasn't a spy; she was like a tennis pro,
and like became a school teacher.
Yeah, and like the only reason she got bionics was because she was dating Steve Austin at the time, and she had a horrible parachuting accident. And Steve said, "Bionic her up." Which is why, like, she talks about in this feeling betrayed when she woke up because she didn't ask for it; she was just given it.
There is a weird conversation about consent in this film.
Yeah, absolutely.
There really, really is, like, men making decisions about women's bodies. I'm not kidding.
No, you're not.
I'm not either.
But oh my god, to go back to the scene of dad grilling in the winter, that scene where they just kind of dump her out of the wheelchair down the stairs.
I'm so mad about that.
And it's just ha ha ha. Oh, you.
She lived there. She's their daughter. She lives there full time. Mm-hmm. And their ramp for her is a piece of plywood down the front steps. What the fuck is that?
Low key, when she's having that conversation earlier on, where like, but you have a family, but you have friends. I'm like, does she though? I've seen her, how her family treated her. Like, yeah, no. I would not be going back to those fuckers.
I did love the random thing of like when she's training for the games. So obviously, young Sandra Bullock has quite an athletic build, but like when she's the Russian that she's running against, who's meant to be a sprinter, looks like a power lifter. Like, she looks like she should be throwing the discus or something, rather than she's really jacked.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, it's the 80s where, all Russian athletes are Ivan Drago, right? That's just kind of how it is.
Especially Russian women athletes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the longest 100 yard dash I've ever seen. Although, again, it's such a little thing. I love this scene, where they're coming out of like the initial qualifying run or something.
Yeah.
And the Russian athlete says something really catty to Kate, and Kate just kind of sticks her tongue out at her.
Yeah.
Like, that's adorable. That's straight up Sandra Bullock. Like, we're going to understand what Sandra Bullock does in a few years.
Yeah.
Like, there's I also question. Oh, so because it's a made-for-TV movie, the World Unity Games are in Toronto.
Yeah,
which because they don't have enough money to go and shoot in Geneva.
No.
And it wouldn't make sense for story purposes to have it in the U.S. or to have it in Russia, because it's the World Unity Games. Yeah, you have to kind of have it on neutral ground, like Toronto.
But is OSI an American organization or an mm-hmm. international organization?
Nope, it's American.
And so they're doing the security, so it would make sense to me that it was happening in the U.S., not in Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah, except obviously, Canada doesn't have their own secret service. They're too nice.
There's a version of this film where we have a bionic Yankee, and not Yankee, a bionic Mountie. And I would love to see that, especially if he's wearing the hat.
I will 100% watch that with you.
They already made that. It's called Due South. Due South is a good show. All right, one of the things I kind of love about the casting of this is because the villain is played by Geraint Wyn-Davies,
mm-hmm.
who is one of those guys who shows up in things that are sort of almost big.
Yeah.
Like, he was in the fourth season of Airwolf when they kind mm-hmm. of completely retooled it. He went on to sort of PBS and they couldn't afford the helicopter anymore, so it's just a bunch of people standing in a room with some stock footage. Like, he was in RoboCop, but RoboCop the series.
Well, he'll be forever known as the forever knight that's not Rick Springfield. We couldn't get Rick Springfield. Bring in Geraint Wyn-Davies.
Just look at his IMDb page. All the stuff like that. Kung Fu: The Legend Continues. Episode of Highlander.
Mm-hmm.
Episode of Tropical Heat.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a working actor that did a lot of guest spots in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, he's one of those people who just sort of turns up and stuff. Oh, that guy!
It's like, I know I've seen this name. Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. I've seen him in, you know, some kind of syndicated, some made-for-syndication TV show at some point. But hey, hats off to Bionic Showdown for only being like the 87th movie to, you know, take on the, you know, American spies that are pissed off about Glasnost.
We're all going to be out of our job!
Spoilers, they'll never be out of their jobs.
Yeah. Bloody world peace coming here, stealing our jobs.
You're going to have a couple years where your life is less interesting and it's going to get interesting again.
Yeah.
Stupid hippie world peace.
I feel like we've talked this one out.
So, I mean, really quick, a couple quick things. One, I did not realize that the Watergate Hotel actually still existed. Like, I would have thought mm-hmm. they would have bulldozed that place after Nixon. Mm-hmm. But instead, you can actually just rent the suite where the mm-hmm. break-in happened, and it's like a super touristy now.
Mm-hmm. Podcast road trip.
Yeah. So, coming at you live from the Watergate Hotel.
So, are you here for the political intrigue history? No, this is where they made the Bionic Showdown.
Think of the cosplay opportunities.
You can pretend to get drunk and belligerent with Steve Austin.
Oh shit! We're all in orange tracksuits.
That was one thing that was just like, there was no sort of the orange tracksuit. They put Steve Austin in just like an overcoat, just like a generic overcoat. It's like, come on, man! Like, put him in some, like, that man's fashion sense in the original series was amazing.
But I will say it. I'll say again. What is the point of being bionic if you don't get the na 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 na? That's the whole point of being bionic.
Yep.
You're in the schoolyard going... running in slow motion, making that noise with your mouth.
Yep. Oh, Danny.
Just let me introduce you to everybody. This is Gina, Roy, Lucas, AJ.
The staff of Empire Records had the coolest jobs on Earth. Nothing left to sing
about this time, it's over. Do you think the story is already written, or do you think a bold and courageous act can change the course of history?
Something happened to me last night in Atlantic City.
Did you win anything?
No, I did not.
But Lucas blew it. Everyone knew it.
You were by Empire?
Well, that's a good thing, right?
The money is gone.
Where's it going to?
I think it's recirculating.
We're turning this into a music town?
I have to pay for what Mr. Brilliant here did.
I'm the idiot. You're the screw-up, and we are all losers.
Now, five friends have one day to decide what to do with the rest of their lives. AJ loves Corey, not the whole story.
Today is the day that I'm gonna tell Corey how I feel about her. That I,
love her.
Yeah.
Do you think that it's possible for someone to be in love with someone else and not even know it?
In this life, there are nothing but possibilities.
That is so sweet, I think I'm gonna barf.
Corey wants Rex first time at sex.
Hey, Rex, what happened to your hair?
I will offer myself to Rex Manning.
I wish I could be brave.
You are brave.
I have to bring Rex's lunch.
I'm bringing Rex's lunch!
Mark's raging mad. Best day he's had.
Just let the
help me, help me, help me.
If I was in a band, they would not be doing this to me.
Deb shaved her head and made out she was dead.
I tried to kill myself with a lady bick.
Just your typical nutty teenager.
You did have hair, right?
I was tired of being invisible.
Gina did it again, this time to a friend.
You get smarter the shorter your skirt gets.
I want to sing in a band, but I don't have the guts.
So is this how your life's gonna be now? You're just gonna screw every husband?
I'm starting!
I get this funny feeling deep inside.
Wanna know more? Check out the store.
Empire Records open till midnight. This is Mark. Midnight!
Empire Records. Featuring the music of Better Than Ezra, Gin Blossoms, Ape Hangers, Evan Dando, Toad the Wet Sprocket, and the Cranberries.
What is wrong with you people?
Rock and roll.
Well, baby, I don't wanna
Next up, we celebrate the beginnings of the career of a young Renee Zellweger, without any Leatherface appearances.
Bam!
I know, I couldn't do it. I could not do it.
I honestly thank you for not doing it.
Yeah. But before Cold Mountain, before Judy, Renee Zellweger found herself in the ensemble cast of Empire Records. Wendy, I know how excited you were to see this. Can you tell us about Empire Records?
I would love to. I love Empire Records. Empire Records is a 1995 teen movie. It was directed by Alan Moyle, who had previously directed both Times Square, one of my favorite movies, and Pump Up the Volume. At the time, movie soundtracks were like really big sellers. And Empire Records is yet another movie developed by a studio to push soundtrack sales, not so much to be a good film. Eventually, they took the film from its director and gave it a tiny, tiny release. It really made no money. But like a lot of things that we talk about, it found its audience when it made the transition to video. And I think it's one of the best teen movies of the 90s. So Empire Records, it's set over the course of 24 hours, and it follows teens and young adults navigating growing up, finding their way, all while working at the coolest record store in Delaware. We meet Lucas, the fuck-up, who's played by Rory Cochrane, AJ, the sensitive artist, played by Johnny Whitworth, who is an adult concerned about the fact that his rent has gone up, who happens to be in love with a high school senior. We meet that high school senior, overachieving Harvard-bound good girl Corey, played by Liv Tyler, who weirdly has a thing for a middle-aged pop star. We meet Deb, played by a pre-The Craft Robin Tunney, who's dealing with a lot of darkness, and Gina, who owns her own sexuality and breaks through her own bullshit to fulfill her dream of singing in a band, played by future Oscar winner Renee Zellweger. In this film, she's fresh off Love in a 45, which won her, I think, an Independent Spirit Award. And she co-starred in that one with her, at the time, boyfriend Rory Cochrane, who encouraged her to audition for this movie. She shows off her pipes and the dance moves that we would later see her bring to Chicago, for which she was nominated for an Oscar before eventually winning Best Actress in a Supporting Role for Cold Mountain in 2004, and then again in 2020 for Best Actress in a Leading Role for Judy. The cast is rounded out by Anthony LaPaglia, who is great in this movie, is like the father figure. Debbie Mazar, who I am always delighted to see in anything. Ethan Embry, Coyote Shivers, and my very favorite cool rider, Maxwell Caulfield, as Rex. The film starts with Lucas being trusted to close the store for the first time. He takes the day's receipts to Atlantic City in a bid to turn $9,000 into enough to save the Empire, which is about to be converted to a Music Town franchise. And he almost gets away with it, but if he did, there wouldn't be a movie. So instead, we follow the aftermath of the theft, how it ruins manager Joe's plans to save the Empire, and showing us the interpersonal and internal struggles of the mostly very pretty crew who works at the record store. Also, Warren Beatty is in this. So, damn the man, save the Empire.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Wendy. Had anybody seen this before?
I have.
No, like a million times.
Okay, it's my first viewing.
It's your first viewing. Okay. Well, Wendy, can you tell me a little bit about your history with this movie?
I mean, I'm too old to have loved this movie in the 90s, but I give no shits about that. I fucking love this movie. I know I didn't see it in the theater. It had such a small release, and I probably would have looked down my nose at it as some dumb teen movie that I was way too cool for. And it's such a delightful movie. I've seen it at least 20 times. And if it's ever on, like, I will stop and watch it. I think it used to be one of those VH1 movies that rock that they would show a lot. But I absolutely love, love, love this movie. It speaks to me. Like, I never worked at a record store, but I had friends who did. And they have stories like this. The writer worked in at Tower Records. And this is based on a lot of her experiences and the people she knew. And, you know, in the 90s, if you were in your teens or even your early 20s, you know a lot of people like this, you know.
Okay, thank you. Will, how about yourself? Where are you with this one?
So I actually watched this one for the first time earlier this year, actually about a week before Rex Manning Day, without realizing that was a thing that people celebrate. but anywho, no, like I watched this and I absolutely like loved it. And the second viewing, it's like, yes, this still holds up. I will buy the eventual like Criterion release when it happens in a couple of years. I mean, it's been on the Criterion channel actually for a few months now. So just saying that usually leads to good things in eventually, but yeah, like I just like, there's so much to love about it. Like there's, the characters are funny. It's so, I know that the original cut of the film, it took place over 2 days. I like though that it, in the re-edit, it does actually take place over a single day, which I think works a lot better for just, you know, story purposes, because if everyone had time to sleep, they might realize, oh, that's kind of a stupid thing to have done. There's a lot, you know, really going on in it. It has like these little like cut, it has these little talking to the audience gags occasionally that I actually real, some movies it doesn't work, but in this one it really does. Just because also I've been perfectly honest, growing up in that age, yeah, a lot of people still talk to, you know, whoever, and it's like, who are you talking to? I don't know, myself. But yeah, it's really great, and yeah, this is the kind of film I'm definitely going to show other people also.
Okay, cool. Dave, how about yourself?
I was aware of this film's existence. I have a couple of friends who have often evangelized about the how wonderful Empire Records is. From the start, I wasn't entirely on board. I think I just found Lucas really grating at the start. Mm-hmm. Like, because, yeah, he's kind of a pretentious dick all the way through this. But as the film went on, I was eventually kind of charmed by everybody else. I especially loved Anthony LaPlaglia in it, just because, like, being the both literal and figurative only adult in the room, yeah, the poor guy who's kind of like accidentally wound up becoming the stupid kid's adoptive dad through being the fact they work in his store, and like every so often, because they drive him so nuts, he has to just lock himself in his office and play the drums very loud, or he'll end up killing someone. So yeah, I thought he was great. yeah, I mean, I thought the rest of the young cast were really good. They each bring sort of something to the table. I mean, obviously, you know, it plays on a lot of the, like, weirdly, it kind of plays on a lot of the high school tropes, but does them in sort of like a work setting, which is like a nice twist. Mm-hmm. You know, because yeah, you know, you've got the kind of, you know, the, you know, quote unquote kind of good girl and the sensitive artist and the dumb stoner and all of that. But yeah, so it's just kind of transferring it to a workplace, which I thought was a nice touch. Maxwell Caulfield turning up in something like it, in anything, is just a joy. And although, like, the fact that, like, even though he's meant to be like an 80s rock star, but like looks like a Vegas magician through all of this, with his sort of feathered hair and velvet jacket, like he's one step away from riding about on a white tiger at this point.
There is so much fringe on that outfit. Yeah.
It's kind of giving Kenny G.
Yeah. But, like he's, I mean, like, I know the kind of British pop star he's meant to be, you know, the, like, kind of ex-New Romantic, kind of, like, your Simon Le Bon or Tony Hadley kind of thing, who's kind of, you know, fallen on, like, still releasing stuff, but nobody really cares. And, yeah, obviously, he is predictably awful. As much as you'd expect. But yeah, I must admit, like, at the end of the film, I was entirely won over by it. And yeah, I probably would give this another watch.
Nice. Thank you very much. I have also seen this a couple of times, not anything to Wendy's extent, but I have seen it a handful of times. And I also like it. There's parts of it that don't work for me, and we'll get into that. But overall, one thing, it is just about, I know I've said this before about other movies, but this is just about the most 90s thing you could ever see. It's incredibly 1990s. Even if there was no soundtrack, it's a very of that era kind of movie. but the cast is really good. The soundtrack is, in fact, kick-ass, and I know we'll talk about that. And I can tell you, and it's so weird, but as somebody that spent a lot of time in and very briefly worked at a Tower Records, it's kind of amazing how accurate the vibe is. Like, that is what Tower Records was like in 1995. It really, really captured it very, very evocatively. So it's kind of like this time capsule of a very specific time in kind of American pop culture, which is it's just fun on that level. The cast, by and large, is really good. Lucas really is like an incredibly annoying dick, but the actor playing him is playing him really well.
I mean, I'd actually seen him quite recently because I've been doing a 24 rewatch, and he turns up in, I think it's series 7, he's kind of like a John Voight's right-hand man. And it was just kind of like a, you know, when you start watching something, it's like, I've seen you, where have I seen you? Like, to IMDb!
Yeah.
And thank God IMDb exists, because otherwise I probably would have just been driven insane by this sort of thing by now.
Because I know that he was on one of the CSIs forever.
Yeah.
But I mean, he'll always be Slater. He was always going to be Slater from Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
That's his lot in life. That's what it's going to say in his obituary. Yeah, his obituary is he's the guy that said Martha Washington was a hip, hip lady.
I mean, like this film did have a couple of lines that did genuinely make me laugh. I mean, like I do sort of like the shoplifter Warren just going from being caught to having weirdly the best afternoon of his life. Like after he hung out at the back for about like 10 minutes, I'm just like, he's going to end up working there, isn't he? Actually, said that out loud.
If I was selling toilets today, I'd be a rich man.
But like the whole bit where. Warren's trying to pull up the quarters that AJ spent the entire day super glueing to the ground. Yeah. It's like, who stuck these quarters down here? I did. Like, well, why'd you do that? I was like, I don't feel compelled to explain my art to you, man. But I love that. That was great. Yeah.
And Ethan Embry is fantastic in this.
He is. He's really great.
I love him in this movie. Again, a character that by all rights should have pissed me off. He was hilarious. I loved him.
He was so great. And I love when he's hallucinating off his pot brownies, which I don't think is a thing.
But
he ends up in a Gwar video, which is amazing.
And then the way his friend makes a mixtape for him, I'm like, oh, that's cute. They're dating.
Yeah. But also, like, if you had like music loving friends at that age, like there was that person who was making you mixtapes because they were going to educate you, right? Because your musical tastes were wrong and they needed to fix you.
Like that little conversation over the credits where they're kind of having that exact kind of conversation was wonderful. And again, if you knew people in that kind of crowd, that conversation was one that you heard thousands of times.
Yeah, I had a lot of college DJ record store employee friends.
Yeah. But the person that I really walk away from this movie thinking was like really incredible, and I wish that people paid more attention to it, is Robin Tunney.
Yeah. Yes.
She is amazing in this movie.
Like, no slight against Renee Zellweger, but if there's like one person, if I were basing it solely off this film that I would have thought they're going to go on to win an Oscar, it would be her.
Yeah.
She's phenomenal, and they give her very little to do, and she does so much with it.
Yeah.
You know, there's that scene where she's in the bathroom and she, you know, she shaves her head. That wasn't in the script. She did that because the studio didn't like her. They thought she was too cute. And, she cut off all her hair and then shaved her actual, that's her shaving her hair, which fucked up the Craft production. And that's why she has a weird wig in the Craft. But it really like sold it. Like she was super committed to that and she brought it. Like, she was so fucking good in that.
I fucking hate this funeral.
Yeah, and in that scene, there's so much going on in her face as well. Like, there's a whole kind of raft of emotions on her face as she's doing it. And yeah, I've been like hearing that actually apparently comes from a very real place as well. Kind of really adds to that, I think. It's kind of good that there are three women in this. They are all different. They all have moments where they get on and where they don't. And it's never just... I mean, basically, they're allowed to have friendships the same way that the guys in the film have friendships, you know? So sometimes they're on each other's side, sometimes they're against each other. Whereas, obviously, a lot of the time, sort of women in films like this kind of either operate as a cliquey unit or they're just constantly scratching each other's eyes out, you know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whereas like, this just kind of felt like a much more organic relationship with kind of like ebbs and flows.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're not always super tight, but that's okay because that's like real... friendship, right? Sometimes they have each other's back and sometimes they don't like each other, but they're always there for each other.
And probably one of the more powerful moments is just when Gina and what's Liv Tyler's character?
Corey.
Yeah, like they have like their massive falling out after Gina sleeps with Rex Manning. Dear Lord. But when sort of everything kind of comes out about who she is, and then the fact that Corey's been taking amphetamines away to studying, and like those two kind of fall apart and get way more aggressive with each other than any of like the male characters in the film, and it's like you can tell, it's coming from a much rawer place for both of them as well, because
that's a fight that's been building for a while.
Yeah, I thought both of them were fantastic in that scene.
I'll be honest, by the end of the film, as much as you're supposed to dislike Lucas, I think I dislike Corey more. Mm-hmm. Which, just because it's like, oh, kind of freaking judgy as all hell here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Corey is a child.
Yeah.
Both Corey and Gina are still seniors in high school. They haven't graduated. So even if they're 18, they're still children.
Yeah.
Whereas Lucas is an adult. AJ is an adult. So I think that we need to give the girls a little bit more space. There's some scenes that are cut that have more of her backstory with her family and with her dad and the pressures on her to succeed. I mean, she really is going to Harvard. She gets in. She finds out that day that she gets in. Her sister delivers the letter to the record store, and then her dad sends flowers to the record store, which is super weird, right?
Yeah.
To the number one graduate of the class of 99, or maybe that's in there, but the sister delivering the letter isn't. There's all this pressure on her. And I'm not sure what those drugs really are. I've kind of assumed that it's Ritalin that she maybe doesn't need.
Yeah.
And that's what she's doing, because that would be the thing that you would take in high school to perform like that. But she is judgy. That's not super uncommon in tight female friendships, especially at that age, to absolutely love your best friend but also hate all of these things about her. Mm-hmm. And the fight is pretty spectacular, and they make up a little too easily, but they were gonna make up, and the movie only gives us a day in the life, so they make up.
And I love the scene, I mean, as gross as it is, where she's in love, she's decided she's in love with Rex Manning, she's got all his records, again, for whatever reason, we don't know. But she decides that she's going to seduce him and that she's going to give him her flower or some shit. But when it actually becomes real, she freaks out and runs off.
Yeah.
That's actually a really nice scene.
Well, and there's another scene that was cut there that kind of showed there's more that Rex does that completely grosses her out. Mm-hmm. He does some really vile. He does something really vile. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what makes her run. But... yeah, I mean, I don't know what the hell that attraction is about, and I'm glad that she runs, because that shouldn't be her experience. She's so much better than Rex Manning.
I mean, I do love poor old Joe, who's quite clearly sees that all of his employees are suffering in some way, keeps trying to go, do you want to talk about it? Like, he kind of doesn't want to, but at the same time acknowledges that they probably do need somebody to talk to, and he's almost kind of relieved when he keeps regularly getting told no. Because he's like, I don't know what... Like, you can see on his eyes, he's like, if they say yes, I've got no idea what I'm going to say, but I feel like I need to say something.
He's a very reluctant father figure to these kids, but for some of these kids, he's really the only involved adult in their life.
Yeah.
It's funny, too, because, like, in real life, this guy would be skeevy as fuck. You know, the grown middle-aged man who surrounds himself with teenagers is a very real thing, especially in that kind of environment, and he would be kind of gross. But I'm glad that he's kind of allowed to be something that, these kids are missing in their lives.
Well, if he wasn't such an upright citizen, he wouldn't catch the eye of Debbie Mazar.
Yet another movie in the 1990s that has Debbie Mazar and doesn't know what to do with her.
She's wasted in so much. She is phenomenal. I don't know why she wasn't bigger. I don't know why she didn't work more. She's still working, but
yeah,
she should have been so much bigger.
Yeah, she's in the fifth Home Alone.
So sad.
She's like one of the thieves in it.
Missy Pyle wouldn't come back?
No. We're going to get Missy Pyle back. But to be fair, they weren't doing, the poor man's Kevin McAllister by that point.
Yeah.
It also has Malcolm McDowell.
Yet another guy, a guy who never says no to anything.
He really doesn't.
So, I like money.
So I've worked in retail for nearly like 20 years now. I will 100%, and I've also found myself becoming fucking Joe, which I don't really like, but at the same time, it's like where I am because where I work, I am always going to be working with college kids, and I can't control that. But what I find like hilarious in here, just comparing like then to now. First off, my store went cashless a couple years ago, but having a $9,000 deposit, even if you take into account the fact that people are using credit cards a lot less back here or checks, a $9,000 deposit after a single day of business is freaking huge. And Jesus Christ, the store is more profitable than a lot of stores are today.
Yeah, a music store, you were not going to lose money in a music store in 1995.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking pre-Napster here, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. Yeah, this is when they were able to charge you almost $20 for a CD with one good song on it, because fuck you, that's the only way you're getting that song.
Yeah, and the fact that they still want to go and, we want to be a music town so we can jack the prices up, and it's like, okay.
Yeah, but that's how we know Mitchell is a dirtbag.
Yeah.
A dirtbag who decides he's going to sell his music store for less than he would get for selling it to Music Town because the movie needs a happy ending.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've had to spend an hour working in a music store and I hate it. Just take it away from me.
I mean, what I've always said is if you forced any number of people who work on even an ownership level, if not a corporate level, to actually work in their stores for a single day, they would cry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Retail is like the worst thing in the world.
Like a lot of the policies that come from these people are things that they will never have to actually live with the consequences of and actually see how much they suck.
Mm-hmm. So I used to work for, a regional supermarket chain, and we had a policy that every Thanksgiving week, all of the corporate employees had to go out to their retail stores to help out. And both of the two, like the most senior people, they would do parking lot duty and just run carriages all day because they didn't want to interact with anybody or do anything public facing. But they had to show that they would do it. They would just go out in the parking lot and hustle cars all day.
Which, I mean, that is like one of the most thankless jobs, so...
It's a physically demanding job, but like, I was the assistant to the president and I would be like running a fucking cash register for a day on the day before Thanksgiving when everybody is an asshole.
Or being a greeter. Even being a greeter is so much more, like, you're having to greet everyone as they're coming in, but you're also having to watch them as they're walking out to make sure, wait, that doesn't have a sticker on it. I need to look at your receipt.
Fucking retail, man.
I mean, I worked at a supermarket for years, and I can tell you that shopping cart duty was, I mean, it was physically very hard work. But you were outside and you weren't getting yelled at by people because the dented can discount wasn't big enough.
It was like the concept of greeters at stores is very American. Mm-hmm. I think they used to do it at the Disney stores over here. And like the first time you experienced it, like, hello, like, what? What?
I think here some of the big box stores do it. I mean, Walmart kind of famously does it as like a, so they can say like, oh, we hire elderly folks from the community. But I think a lot of the stores that do it here now, really, they're not really there to greet you. They're really to make sure you're not like running out the door with stuff on the way out. They don't so much care about the way in.
Mm-hmm. And then also for security purposes, okay, this person walked in wearing a big jacket that obviously they are going to try and be cramming stuff into pockets.
Which brings us back to Warren.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's so great. Yeah. So I've seen this film a gazillion times and I've not recognized who that actor is. And he's like still working, I think, but he was in Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Yeah, he was.
He was the creepy fucking kid in Welcome to the Dollhouse, which is a movie full of creepy fucking kids. Mm-hmm. But he was the one who was harassing and threatening Dawn constantly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I looked him up and like, he was in Russian Doll. He was in like 6 episodes of Russian Doll.
Yeah, and he was. He was really good. He was really, really good. Again, that's a plot line that you really have to work very hard to swallow. Because he straight up commits armed robbery. Yeah. You know, even if the gun wasn't loaded, that is the dictionary definition of armed robbery. And he gets to basically leave the police station and gets a job. Within an hour.
Yeah. I was just reading, like, the actor was in the movie Black Hawk Down, and he alleges that he was blacklisted from Hollywood because the version of the film that got released, it is significantly dumbed down from the one he says he was in, where it was talking out against the U.S. military as opposed to, oh, look, isn't the U.S. military awesome? Mm-hmm. Directed by Ridley Scott.
But I want to talk a little bit about some of the stuff that didn't work for me in this movie.
Okay.
Which is basically, this movie is a dramedy. This movie tries to balance being like a goofy teen comedy with being, you know, a teen soap opera, essentially. And the dramatic, like when it got dramatic, it really wasn't doing it for me, generally speaking. And it just felt tonally very off, because a lot of the comedy was like cartoonish in a way. It just didn't, for me, it just didn't mesh very well. I don't know if other people felt differently.
I didn't mind it. I thought it got like the kind of, like in a way, for a film like that, you kind of need those moments of drama to kind of almost kind of make you believe when the comedy comes back, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's a common thing in a lot of these, I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I think like Dazed and Confused has similar moments, doesn't it? Of like, you know, mm-hmm. it's mostly funny, but you do get a couple of moments of intense drama.
Sure.
Clarks, which came out obviously a year before this, was
very Clarks? Much... Wow, you are so British, man.
I am so sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for being
I've
from the
never
country
heard it
I
called
am
that.
From.
I've never heard it called that before, but I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Please go on. I apologize. Please.
Good. Clerks.
I have to talk to the Clark to get some aluminium.
Sorry.
Yeah, see, that's a perfectly pronounced sentence. Well, that will.
For my laboratory.
But yes. But like so... that also was like another kind of very similar sort of slice of life in kind of 90s retail, mm-hmm. which kind of mixed that kind of drama and comedy, which was originally going to have like a much darker ending of,
yeah.
Randall, Dante getting shot in a robbery, but they have to realize that, oh, that's actually probably just too dark for this. So yeah, when I started watching, it was one of the first things I looked up was like, when was the Clerks released in relation to this?
A year before.
Yeah, and that's one of the, I found out it was like a year before, but it's because I was like, so this was just like a trend in cinema. It wasn't just like they were kind of jumping on the bandwagon, as it were.
Yeah, Mallrats was like a month later.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was definitely kind of a bit of a trend in those kind of like teen comedies. It's just all like a day in the life kind of thing. You just get to see sort of like a little slice of what it's like to live in this community with these people and stuff. And like, I think, generally speaking, you do, in all of those films, you do tend to get that moment of more intense drama, if only so you can then have it kind of dispelled and then get to your feel-good ending. But you kind of need to have it in order to kind of get to the feel-good place. Is it as well executed here as in other places? I mean, yeah, obviously, you know, your mileage may vary, but I didn't mind it.
Okay.
Yeah, like Gwen's funeral is honestly like one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it was stupid in MASH, and I didn't like it in this either. but that's, again, your mileage may vary.
Yeah, no, I think the funeral is really, really well done. I think this stuff kind of leading up to understanding why Deb is so upset and has so much darkness is not handled well. Mm-hmm. It's not really super clear, but she and Verko are a couple and they've had some kind of massive, you know, argument, and which led to her attempting to take her own life, even though she kind of talks about other things. At that moment with her and Joe in the booth, it's really, really nice.
Well, she's great. Yeah. But again, because I think she can carry that in a way that some of the other actors maybe can't. Although I will say, any scene that gives us the line, "I fucking hate this funeral," I will give it a pass, because that was a great line and great delivery.
The whole unfolding of the love story with AJ and Corey is just weird. Yeah. Like, he's too old for her, even though they're not really, I think, that far apart in age. A young man living on his own and a high school senior living in, you know, a suburban home. That's not okay. That's not okay. And maybe her behavior is the correct behavior for this still unformed young person dealing with these complex emotions. Because she, I mean, Liv Tyler is super overdramatic and not believable as somebody with human emotions in this. But, you know, she's a high school girl, you know, and he's doesn't make any sense either. I don't understand what he brings to the table. And that stupid thing at the end, when he tells her he's quit and he's quit his job at Empire and he's going to art school. It's fucking April 8th. Yeah. School starts in the end of August.
And admission is over.
He needs to pay his rent. I mean, maybe he's not going to apply to a very prestigious school and he can just get in and that's fine. Maybe in the 90s, we had a lot of colleges. We still have a lot of colleges here in Boston. We had a lot. There were, for everyone that's super prestigious, there's a lot that you can just show up at. but how the fuck is he going to live between April 8th? Rex Manning Day is celebrated every year on April 8th. And when he gets to Boston, where he's, by the way, going to have to pay fucking tuition and live in an apartment or a dorm. Like, it just, it makes no fucking sense. So that's what bugs me.
It'll all be fine, probably. I've got nothing. I don't know how life works.
I mean, I will say that in Boston at that time, especially, there were neighborhoods where you could get an apartment for not very, like, you where you could live on a working at a record store salary. That's so incredibly not the case anymore. But even so, that was going to be a struggle for him.
No, he absolutely could have moved into the neighborhood you were living in the mid-90s or the neighborhood I was living in the mid-90s and maybe had a roommate and been fine. But what the hell was he going to do between April and August if he quit his job? Like, that's just fucking stupid.
Mm-hmm. Pack. I don't know.
Glue some more quarters and stuff.
Yeah.
He needs those fucking quarters back.
Yeah, a hammer and chisel knocking them off.
he was skimming money from the Save the Empire sale.
I will say one thing that it just tickles me is this movie was very clearly made with having an R rating in mind.
Yeah.
And was edited to not, like, there's scenes where, like, you know, you see Joel Apollo saying things like, don't fun with me, you know, things like that. But it's amazing the gymnastics this movie goes to avoid saying the word marijuana. Yeah.
These characters swear and fuck and smoke and take drugs, but they don't say any of it.
Extra sugar.
Yeah. It's amazing how hard this movie works to not show that stuff.
I mentioned the special brownies you like.
Like with extra sugar.
Yeah. Like, you know, obviously, you know, just enough to give it that because the thing is, in 1995, any mention, an especially visual representation of weed, automatic R rating.
Thank you, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. But like, oh, like, obviously that's what's going on, but there was just enough there that they could say,
maybe it's just not too much sugar.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a scene where Burko lights up a cigarette, but you never actually see him smoke it.
Yeah. Yeah.
When's the last time you saw cigarettes in a movie?
It's been a very long time.
Anora last week.
Okay.
But they're Russian.
Yeah.
And then Gina and Rex, again, I'm pretty sure Gina's underage.
Oh, I gotta give it to Maxwell Caulfield. He was great as this character.
He's amazing. Like, this storyline is fucked up and it's probably based on something that the writer experienced or, you know, saw at the record store. I 100% believe that. He is amazing as this character, who is just such a pompous fucking ass. But also, you know, he's there to promote his new album and sign and give out autographs. And everybody in line is like, oh, I loved you when I was in high school. Or I don't know who the fuck you are, but this was signed this to Debbie. That's my mom's name.
Or a weird opera singer girl woman.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the guy who's dressed up like it. Like, it's sad, right? It's like the sad tail end of somebody's career.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I will say probably where Renee Zellweger, though, I think you see the most shine of who she is going to eventually come is at the end with Sugar High. Mm-hmm. Like, that is, I think, probably, that is, like, my absolute favorite moment of the entire movie. And I think it's actually a travesty that version is not in the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
Speaking of the soundtrack, I think, Wendy, you and I were talking about this last night. People, like, look back on them now, say, yeah, they were, I mean, you know, it brings me that kind of mid-90s nostalgicness that I really enjoy, and, you know, they're great. In 1995, I never met a single person who actually liked the Gin Blossoms. Like, they were fine. They were fine.
Nobody liked the Gin Blossoms. Like, I don't want to say, I don't think industry plant is the right word, but they had a really good fucking marketing team that had us all convinced, like, they were great. They weren't. They were
the story,
adequate.
The story always was that the record industry, and they're not by any stretch of the imagination the only band that this is said about, that the record industry would, like, buy advertising time on radio stations, like 3 minutes of advertising time, and then use that to play the record. That's the story.
I mean, we talked about this. Like, I remember going to, like, concerts for weirdo bands, and for whatever reason, there was some A&R guy there, like, giving out Gin Blossoms singles. Like, yeah. This is not the Gin Blossoms audience, sir. You're at a punk show? Like, what are you doing here, guy?
I have literally never heard of them.
No. They had, like, three or four pretty major hits in the mid-90s, but it's like nobody actually seemed to like them. They were just always on.
Yeah, and like you said, like, now when one will come on the radio, like, it's nostalgic. Like, I like it for the nostalgia factor, but mm-hmm. Hey Jealousy was not a good song, but I'll totally sing along in the car now.
Yeah. Like, I remember this same year, 1995, I went to, there was a radio, like, back then when radio stations would, like, have these all-day festivals where bands would come out and, like, they'd play for 20 minutes and then they'd get a new band out.
Those were so great.
Those were so great. And they came on and they didn't know where they were. They made like they accidentally said like something to the effect of "Hello, Cleveland," and it was and then so he spent the rest of the set just kind of, you know, "It's so great to be at WrestleMania," or something, you know, just making that joke over and over again to kind of cover it. But like that was the band when everybody got up to go to the bathroom or check the merch table, or, you know, like nobody was there to see the Gin Blossoms, but they had the big single off this soundtrack, apparently.
Yeah, lead song.
This movie isn't about being a movie. This movie is made to sell records.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's why they work at a record store.
Yeah.
Cuz they could work anywhere, right? It could be mm-hmm. they could work in a convenience, they could do any kind of retail. But mm-hmm. they work in a record store so we could have all the music so that they can sell records. Mm-hmm. And that's why like that version of Sugar High isn't on the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Cuz there's only things that the studio owns is on the soundtrack. There's so much great music that's not.
Like if the film had been more successful, we would have gotten more songs from Empire Records, because you had that with like Dazed and Confused and so mm-hmm. many other like movie made to sell a soundtrack.
Yeah. Wendy, do you know why? Because I know that this was initially supposed to have a wide release and it didn't get one. Like at the last minute it was pulled and it only showed up on like 80 screens or some shit. Do you know why that is?
Well, what I have read is that the initial test audience release went really, really well. Like the test screening was showed to the target audience, which was like suburban white kids. And then they did a second test screening to a population who was not their target audience, and they did not like it. Mm-hmm. And the studio made some, I don't know if at that point they made more edits, but this movie was taken away from the director and cut by the studio. But I know following that, that bad test screening, they released it on less than 100 screens. Mm-hmm. And in most cities that had it for less, you know, had it for the 2 weeks that you have a new release and then it's gone.
Yeah. Cause I know that the soundtrack sold like 10 million copies, but
like not overnight. That took time.
Yeah. But like the movie itself only made like $300,000 in the theater.
Yeah, and it was like I remember the video though was like one of those mainstays of the video rental place, because I remember seeing this video cover for like years with, you know, Liv Tyler in the front and mm-hmm. Robin Tooney in the back, and I was like, okay, that looks interesting. Maybe next time I'll rent it.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that cover? Because like it's lovely. Like all of the cast is in it. There's a dog on the cover of mm-hmm. that, and I think he's on the movie poster. But there's no dog anywhere in this movie.
Like, I think it may be invoking like the RCA dog.
Oh! Mm. Oh! I bet you're right! Oh! When they're cut through the record store, there might be a little RCA dog. Okay, I think he's a prop in the record store. Thank you.
Okay. That makes sense.
Thank you for solving the eternal mystery of the Empire Records poster for me.
You're welcome. I try.
But this might be the platonic ideal of the Gen X movie.
Yeah, possibly.
Like, it might not be the best Gen X movie, but it's like the platonic ideal of it.
Are they Gen X? Are these Xennials?
I think they fall under Gen X because they're about the right age.
Then yeah, just barely.
Like, it's 1995. I would have been. That's the year I turned 21. So I would have been that age, and I'm most definitely Gen X.
But again, like, Corey and Gina are like maybe 18, maybe 17.
That's only like that would still fall within a 70s birthday.
Okay.
And even if they're a bit younger, like, the target audience, I think, is squarely Gen X. Mm-hmm. Even if some of the characters are a bit younger.
Like, this never felt to me like one of those teen movies that's actually aimed at preteens. This felt like a movie that's aimed at the people it's about.
No, I mean, this is a super fun movie. I'm so glad that we watched it, and I'm so glad that Renee Zellweger was in it, so we got to fit it into this theme.
Well, I expect we'll be doing this theme again at some point, because there's just too many good movies.
And I'm going to point out that there's a more than a good chance it would have came up in the next season or two. Mm-hmm. No matter what.
Yeah. We will get Return of the Killer Tomatoes on this show at some point.
it's inevitable.
Yeah.
I need my COOLRIDER.
Yeah, I'm sure. But until then, dear listeners, thank you for joining us. Thank you for being here. Please take care of yourselves. Drink some water and go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show was presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Toland. Well, that's it for me for another season. Time to get busy sitting in a hot tub listening to podcasts about the Russian Revolution while drinking Capri Suns full of sangria. School's out.
Oh, I get a huge echo on you, Wendy.
I mean, you wanted me to try this new headset.
I did. I'm coming in louder and clearer than ever before.
It didn't start until the recording. That's the weird part.
That is the weird part.
So, yes, God.